Welcome back to the Policy Viz podcast. I'm your host, John Schwabish. I hope you're out there having a great holiday season. And thanks for tuning back in, because on this week's show, I am very excited to have Randy Olson, data visualization, machine learning, expert tweeter extraordinaire. Randy, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. How is your holiday season starting off?
Going pretty well, just taking it easy this week, you know. It's really, really cold here in Philadelphia, so sorry if I get the shivers while I'm talking. It's even cold in this room.
Finally getting a taste of winter, but and soon we'll be complaining about, you know, it's too cold, and then we'll be complaining it's too hot, and so that's, you know, that's just the way it is, I guess.
The circle of life.
The circle of life, that's right. We've got a few big things I want to dig into, because you have a really cool project on national parks and then you do a lot of interesting research on machine learning, and I want to talk about both of those. But before I dive into some specific questions, can you maybe introduce yourself for folks and give a little bit of your background?
Yeah, sure. I can give a brief synopsis, I guess, of who I am. So yeah, I think, you know, data viz and machine learning guru is a good way to explain myself. Tweeter extraordinaire. Sure.
You'll take it, right?
Yeah, I've started running out of time for that lately, but I still try to keep on top of it. But yeah, so basically, formally, I'm a senior data scientist at the University of Pennsylvania Institute for Biomedical Informatics. And that's basically a fancy title for a really cool job that I have here, where I basically get to spend all of my time developing machine learning software, developing machine learning methods and applying them to biomedical data at the University of Pennsylvania. So I'm basically just, you know, geeking out 24/7 or close to it over data and machine learning and data viz, you know, all the stuff I ever dreamed of when I was in grad school, which, by the way, leads. I was a PhD student at Michigan State University. I will still say go green, even though this has been a really terrible season for us in football. I'm still a proud Spartan. I studied computer science there, studied computer science in undergrad. So basically a decade straight of computer science education building up to the ultimate nerdy job now.
Nice.
Also on the side, when I was in grad school, I started a hobby of blogging about data and data visualization and eventually machine learning. And that led to, I presume, some of the projects we'll talk about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also interested in talking about how your work in the computer science lab overlaps with the health providers, I guess, as it were, at the rest of the university. But before we dive into that, I want to talk about one of your latest projects, I guess, would be your optimal road trip to the U.S. National Parks project, which was super fun. And I've been exploring it to see how I can take the kids on a fun national parks tour the fastest way possible. Because I'm not sure how many hours in the car I can handle with both kids. But do you want to talk a little bit about that and what was the inspiration and how you developed it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, you know, it's the centennial for the National Park Service. And so, you know, I wanted to do something to help celebrate that, to help encourage people to, you know, get out there and even visit, you know, even just a few of the parks and see, you know, the really beautiful parks that we've organized over the years. And so somebody gave me this idea. You know, I've become a little bit famous or infamous or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, designing these optimal road trips that can hit a whole bunch of locations in the fastest time possible. And someone suggested, oh, why don't you try to do that for all the national parks? So that's basically what this trip is, you know, is it tries to hit every single national park in the U.S. As quickly as possible. With meaning as little driving as possible. And it ends up being this epic, you know, multi-day trip that I think would at least take you a couple months to finish. But wow, it would be an amazing trip. I wish I had the time to go on it.
Yeah. And how did you develop the algorithm to, I guess, minimize the driving time and maximize the adventure?
Yeah. So that started, gosh, has it been almost 2 years now?
Hmm.
Wow. Time flies. It has a bit of a funny beginning because I originally developed that algorithm when I was writing up my dissertation for my PhD. And as with all PhD students, I was looking for a distraction from writing my dissertation. And so one weekend when it was really snowy in Michigan, which tends to happen a lot during the winter, I was snowed in for the weekend. My weekend plans were canceled. So I turn to what else but my, you know, data hobby, my data blogging hobby. And I found this really cool article on Slate.com that talked about finding Waldo from the Where's Waldo children's books as quickly as possible using math. And they came up with a pretty good technique for doing that. And I was pretty impressed. But at the same time, I had been studying and applying machine learning for several years at that point. And I said, you know what? I bet I can reach into my bag of machine learning tricks and do better than that. So that's exactly what I did that weekend. I basically treated finding Waldo as a traveling salesman problem, and tried to sort of optimize that path on finding him as quickly as possible. And so using this machine learning algorithm, I was able to do that and effectively solve Waldo. I was able to discover a path across the Where's Waldo pages. If I remember right, it was an average of 10 seconds or so. So that was a pretty cool result because, I mean, you know, I basically solved an age-old problem that at least I grew up with of finding Waldo.
Yeah.
he always hid from me. And now, you know, when I have kids, I can impress them and be like, look at how cool dad is. He can find Waldo in like 10 seconds. You know, his dad is amazing.
Right.
He's super dad.
Right.
And so I shared that as a blog post. And then I was contacted by a reporter at Discovery News, Tracy Setter, the next weekend. And she said, you know, hey, this is this problem that you're solving here, this traveling salesman problem where you're trying to hit, you know, every point on the page as quickly as possible. This is very similar to what we do when we design road trips, right? I mean, when some of us design road trips, you know, we choose where we want to go. And then we, unless we really, really love driving, we try to find the shortest path possible to get to all those places. And so I said, yeah, that sounds, you know, exactly like the same kind of problem. And so I spent the next weekend, even though it wasn't snowed in that weekend, spent that next weekend working on that. And I came up with this algorithm to optimize road trips using Google Maps directions.
Right. What I love about the post is your walkthrough and the image, of course, the Google Maps image. But the comments are probably the best part. People debating which parks are worth including or excluding, how much it would cost to do all the parks. Now, how many of these parks have you actually visited?
Unfortunately, I've only visited a few myself. But I keep designing these road trips, epic road trips, and being like, I'm going to do it one day. I'm going to do it one day. But it is very difficult to get, you know, most of these road trips require at least a couple months to do them in full. A follow-up post to that original one actually focused on, you know, how can you optimize, you know, subsets of these trips, you know, like let's say you have 48 hours, you have a weekend, you know, and you want to do the biggest road trip possible out of that. You can do that as well.
Right.
Yeah. So I haven't got to do much traveling myself, but there have been, I've already been contacted by a couple people who have done at least a large portion of this National Parks road trip. Not the original road trip that was hitting a major landmark in every state. At least a dozen people have done that now. It's really amazing. You know, people see these maps, these trips on the internet, and they say, I'm going to do that.
Right.
Those people are really inspiring to me.
Now, what would it take for you to modify this to do, say, the optimal road trip for, you know, you've seen these a lot of, like, optimal road trip for going to every baseball stadium, you know, during the season, or every football stadium. How would you think about doing that when you're adding an element where you can only be in Seattle or in San Francisco at a particular time?
Right. So I mean, that's a very, very similar problem, except basically adding time constraints.
Yeah.
Right. There's actually, funny enough, another article on Slate that does exactly that.
Oh, okay.
using a different method. But they're able to find, you know, like an optimized road trip under these time constraints as well. But it's certainly possible. I mean, all these algorithms in some sense are trying to optimize some criteria. You know, for my algorithm, it's minimizing the number of miles that you drive. And you can sort of make that a multi-objective problem where you say, you know, minimize the number of miles that we drive, but also take these time constraints into account as well. You know, we can't go back in time to go to a game that happened last week or something.
Right.
So,
right.
So I mean, that's a big field of research, but it certainly complicates the problem because you can't just, you know, visit any place at any time of the year anymore.
Right. So let's turn to some more of your full-time research, not just the fun stuff, although I'm guess it sounds like your full-time research is the fun stuff as well. Can you talk a little bit about the machine learning types of work that you do? And you had mentioned that it's biomedical stuff. So how much does it overlap, or how much do you interact with, I should say, with the folks who are actually in the Penn Hospital and using some of the tools and techniques that you are developing?
Yeah, sure. So basically the road trip stuff was one kind of machine learning algorithm, an optimization algorithm that I like to use. In my day-to-day work, I use more standard statistical machine learning methods. Folks who are familiar with machine learning, things like random forests or logistic regression, all that fun stuff. So the work that I do, I actually work a fair bit with Penn physicians. We actually, as a part of this institute that I'm a part of, we have this whole room, called the Idea Factory. And basically the whole point of this room is for Penn physicians, Penn researchers to come in, with their data sets or with issues. And we have a whole bunch of data scientists, including myself there, to bring that technical expertise to their research. So they obviously have way, way more experience than us than working with, the actual patients and working with the data. But in terms of actually applying machine learning to it, that's where we come in. We help them design the experiments, how to properly sample the data, doing the initial exploratory data analysis, doing some basic modeling, all that stuff. So we work, quite a bit with the Penn data. But as far as collecting the data, I have to say, for me at least, thankfully, I don't have to work much with the patients or anything. There's definitely a big focus on actually building tools that are actually useful for the hospital, building a model that can predict the need for beds in the emergency room, for example. A lot of the things, not just at Penn, but at hospital systems all around the country, they sort of just use rules of thumb or heuristics, about guessing, when a patient needs extra care or, when we have to adjust something about the hospital. So now we're trying to use machine learning, trying to use a data-driven approach to improve those decision-making processes. So it's pretty cool because my PhD research focused on a lot of theoretical stuff, but now I actually get to build machine learning applications that have, direct uses for the Penn Hospital and also improving people's healthcare at Penn. So it's been a really nice position so far.
Yeah, very applied. So are you pulling in then real-time data? You have a patient who's in the ER and you're trying to predict, something health-wise, moving up to the ICU, moving out of the hospital. So are you pulling in real-time biometric data and running that through an algorithm and constantly updating it?
I know. So far we have not been working on real-time stuff in our institute. However, there is a really, really good data science team working directly within the hospital as well, who they are doing that. They've built this Penn Signals application that they're integrating directly into the hospital system that processes information in real time, makes predictions about the patient's health. And also, just does basic things like providing, the number of tests that a patient has had and stuff like that. The history, things that normally is just a stack of paper that the physician has to look through. Now they have a nice computer interface for that. But as far as our work, most of the time we gather the data ahead of time. And even we design an experiment and gather the data in a specific way. And then we start modeling around that, so we try to account for things like most diseases tend to be fairly rare in the population. So we have to, account for class imbalances in the data and things like that. So, we usually don't work with real-time data, at least not yet, but that doesn't mean we won't in the near future.
Right. One of the things we've seen recently with the election and the discussion after the election, at least with regards to polling, is this idea of uncertainty and how we convey uncertainty and whether people understand uncertainty. Do you find that that is an issue you need to tackle when you are trying to build these algorithms and communicate patient information to doctors where there's an X percent chance that this patient could or need could do this or need this, and yet there's uncertainty around that?
Well, I mean, so as far as communicating that information to the physicians, thankfully, that's really easy. That's sort of a world that they live in, it seems, which has been a relief. You know, I mean, it's very standard terminology to say that someone is at risk or not at risk. That, you know, it's implied that there's a probability there. Just because you're at risk doesn't mean you're going to develop this disease, right? And then there's a gray area there where, you know, you can have certain levels of being at risk and so on and so forth. So as far as communicating that information to the physicians and researchers, been pretty easy. But I mean, obviously communicating that to the general populace is much, much harder. You know, one of the things that I tweeted about the election is, you know, gosh, what were the probabilities of Trump winning the day prior to the election? Like 30%?
I think it was like 15-20% or something like that, according to the Upshot, I believe.
Yeah, so I mean, there were numbers all over the place, but all of them were fairly low. And my tweet was pointing out that, you know, just because it says 15%, 20%, it doesn't mean it's impossible, right? You know, it's not out of the window.
Nope.
And so we had a firsthand lesson during the election there that rare events can happen. I think there's still it's still a tremendous challenge communicating the concept of probability.
Yeah, absolutely.
To the general population. I mean, I won't like, you know, sit on a high horse here and pretend that I don't fall susceptible to it too. You know, it takes a certain mindset to think probabilistically. To think, you know, when someone says you're at risk of some disease, you're not doomed. And personally, I've still fallen, you know, prey to that. I mean, every day when we look at the weather forecast, if I see 10% chance of rain, 20% chance of rain, I say, yeah, it's not going to rain. And then I get pissed off when it does rain and I didn't bring my umbrella. You know, so we live in a probabilistic world, and so it's takes practice to think probabilistically.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you also thinking about hardware when you're developing the algorithms, or is that someone else's job? So I'm thinking of in the healthcare field, there's obviously been a lot of change in the software and the technology they're using, but they're also moving. I would guess, in my fortunate brief interactions with the healthcare field, that, you know, moving from stationary desktop to computers to laptops to mobile tablet devices. So are you thinking about how people would use your dashboards or your visualizations in those sorts of different platforms?
Oh, yeah. So a couple things to say there. So, yeah, absolutely. We're considering hardware because, I mean, we can't always expect people to have, you know, really powerful machines right there when they're dealing with the patients. You know, sometimes they're just using tablets or whatever else. So in this Idea Factory, we focus largely on web-based interfaces that people can log into and interact with and, you know, make it very, very swipey and very interacty and all that good stuff. So absolutely, that's been a major consideration. And another thing is that's been particularly exciting here is that we have a large fund for building an actual computing center behind this whole visualization room. And so one of the greatest things that we've had is the ability to build an AI behind everything that's going on here. So sort of an AI assistant, almost on the level of, if you've seen the movie Idiocracy, you know, they have the sort of AI doctor, you know, you plug in something to like your mouth and something in your butt, and then it gives you, you know, it tells you. It's not on that level, but, you know, that's, I won't say that's what we're building towards, but think of something like that, right?
We're going to
have an AI assistant that when people bring in their data sets or whatever else, it can help them along the way, you know, applying the right machine learning methods or whatever else.
Right.
In addition to considering the fact that, you know, people are going to be using our tools on a tablet, you know, or a phone, which, you know, has decent computing power, but not the computing power that we need for machine learning, we're also dealing with the fact that we do have algorithms that can use a lot of computing power, and we have that as well on the back end. So it's quite nice building, you know, a very lightweight front end that works on all kinds of hardware. but also connects into a much more powerful computing system in the back end.
Right. Really interesting. Before we finish up, I wanted to ask you where you think machine learning and the sort of work that you're doing is going to be in the next year or 5 years.
So I mean, one thing that's actually directly relevant to my research, I think, is there's been this huge growth in this idea of automated machine learning. So basically, automated machine learning is this idea that machine learning is quite powerful, right? And then it allows computers and machines to learn from data and make predictions from that data. But it's actually still pretty laborious to actually design those machine learning algorithms, to code them up, to select the right parameters, to process the data in the right way. So we've put a tremendous effort in our institute here into this idea of automated machine learning, where we have sort of a meta algorithm on top of this entire machine learning and almost the full, you know, data science workflow to automate that entire process of processing the data all the way to modeling it and delivering that final model to production. So I think there's going to be a tremendous focus, especially coming up over the next couple of years, improving upon these automated machine learning algorithms, because they're going to relieve machine learning researchers and machine learning practitioners from the sort of boring process of doing the really basic stuff of selecting the right model, optimizing its parameters, yada, 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 and freeing them to work on the harder problem of machine learning, which is thinking in the right terms. You know, how do we pose this as a data problem? How do we pose this as a machine learning problem? And how do we do it in a way that it's actually useful for my company or for my institute or whatever else? So I think that's going to be a tremendous focus. And we've already seen, even just this year, some really nice progress in this field where we have these automated machine learning systems actually beating hundreds of machine learning experts on, let's say, Kaggle problems or other machine learning competition problems. So it's really, really promising, really, really exciting. And so, you know, just Google up automated machine learning if you want to learn more about that, I suppose.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating, and it sounds exciting. I mean, it sounds exciting for what we're able to see over the next few years, so that's great. Randy, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great chatting with you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to take your optimal road trip to the U.S. National Parks, you should go check out Randy's site at randallolson.com. And I'll put a link to that post and the rest of his website on the show notes. So until next time, this has been the Policy Viz podcast. Thanks so much for listening.